section today and then have the tape available for the section tomorrow. So that's the only reason for the tape recorder. I hope it won't inhibit you if you have a comment to make. The first thing I'd like to do today is change the due date of the paper. It was due at 5 o'clock Friday, and I'm now going to make it due at class time on Monday. At class time on Monday. Now you'll hear from Section 3 that the paper is due for them at 5 o'clock on Monday, but that's true for them, but not for you. They don't meet till Tuesday, so they turn it in at 5 on Monday. You're to turn it in. It is due at class time, the beginning of class time on Monday. And you remember that whole spiel about due dates. That way, I'll be sure you'll come to class, and we'll have a great discussion because you will have thought about the subject in order to write the paper. Any questions about when it's due now? All right. One other thing about the paper. The paper assignment is rather straightforward. I think there is probably one little device that you'd find useful. I suspect that in order to give a clear statement of Thrasymachus' position in question one, you'll find it useful to give a very brief statement of Cephalus and Polemarchus' views so that you can then show what Thrasymachus is rebelling against. Thrasymachus enters as a kind of rebel. He's rejecting what's gone before as, he says, high-minded innocent, sort of a milquetoast view of justice. And you may need to state that earlier view or views in order to show clearly what Thrasymachus is rebelling against. Question about the paper.
Would you prefer that we keep all these questions separate and do a page on each question, or do you have any objections?
I would prefer that you do it that way, although it's admittedly a bit artificial in the case of 1 and 2, because you're going to find that in the case of number 1, for instance, Polemarchus changes his mind under the prodding of Socrates, and so you'll need to say, well, Socrates leads him to X, Y, or Z. And then in the second question, say, here's what Socrates did to lead him to X, Y, or Z. So it's a bit artificial, but I want you to try to get clear in your own mind what contribution Polemarchus makes and what contribution Socrates makes, even though those two things are intertwined in the dialogue. So I admit it's artificiality, but other questions? A second announcement. I'm going to have a meeting of the people who are doing the H option for organizational purposes to decide what our regular meeting time will be and how we'll divide the text at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I don't yet have a room, so we'll meet at my office and then go to a vacant room. So if you're going to do the H option, please meet with me at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And if you simply can't meet then, see me the next class hour and I'll let you know what happened at that meeting. Now, we've talked about the Cephalus section at some length, and we're about to take up the Polemarchus section. Before we actually begin Polemarchus' discussion with Socrates, however, it's once again important to look at the action of the dialogue. Something happens between the Cephalus and the Polemarchus sections, and what happens is significant for the viewpoints that are pursued in the subsequent section, the Polemarchus speeches. Polemarchus interrupts the discussion between Cephalus and Socrates at a significant point. He leaps into the argument at exactly that place where his father seems to be on the verge of caving in or giving up to Socrates. Of course, unbeknown to Polemarchus, Cephalus is actually going to leave. He's not going to stay to admit his full defeat. But Polemarchus interrupts, we could say, to defend his father's position, to guard his father's position, which of course turns out to be his own position, because his father is going to pass on what is his to his son. Polemarchus is Cephalus' heir. So Polemarchus' act is at this one and the same time an act of filial piety. He's acting like a good son, but it's also a selfish act. He's concerned to protect what is his father's, which will become his own. Now, what we see him protecting, it turns out, is of course Cephalus' position in argument, not Cephalus' property in the ordinary sense. And in fact, what he ends up protecting as Cephalus' position is not the whole of Cephalus' position. We've already noticed that Socrates reduces that position to about half, and even to the less significant half with which Cephalus had begun. Socrates omits piety. But now Polemarchus, in restating Socrates' summary of Cephalus's view, leaves off another hand. At the bottom of page 7, Polemarchus, relying on the poet Simonides, gives this supposed account of what his father had held regarding justice, that it is just to give to each what is owed. Now, what does that omit that even Socrates had allowed Cephalus to include? Truth, and especially truth-telling, which Socrates made clear as he progressed. So Polemarchus is silent about truth-telling. And Socrates conspires in Polemarchus's oversight. Socrates doesn't draw to his attention the fact that he's dropped this half. Now, I want to say two things about that omission before we proceed to talk about what they actually do say. First of all, I've suggested that Socrates is in the process of substituting a new authority for the old poetic authorities or religious authorities. He's substituting the authority of unassisted human reason as it appears in this dialogue. The omissions at the beginning of the dialogue are significant because they're not permanent omissions, and they re-enter the discussion later, but in a new way. Let me put it as follows. Both piety and the issue of truth-telling will re-enter the discussion, but they will re-enter not as goods in themselves, as unquestionable values, but as unassisted human reason teaches that they are useful. Let me repeat it. Both piety and truth-telling will re-enter the discussion, not as good in themselves, but as serving other values which have been discovered by unassisted human reason. It's important to reflect on a second thing about truth-telling itself. We've already seen in the line of questioning suggested by Socrates' example to Cephalus that possessing the truth is crucial for an improved understanding of justice. You remember we talked about how the use of property is perhaps a better standard of justice than its conventional ownership, but how property can be redistributed in that way only if there is somebody who possesses a certain expertise or knowledge, namely, what is the proper use of property, and who can use it that way? So somebody must know the truth about those things. But is knowing the truth identical with telling the truth? You see, now what they're talking about is not simply knowing it, but telling it. More specifically, will people do what is best for them if and only if they are told the truth about what is best for them? Among other difficulties, this possibility would require that each person be able to understand the full truth of what is best for him and her, him or her. And because the person can understand the full truth, that person can then act on the truth. If this ability to understand the full truth, even about oneself, does not exist equally in all people, then justice may require not truth-telling, but effective lying. That is to say, justice may require that kind of lying that will get people to do what in fact is best for them, even though they're not able to understand what is best for them. Justice may require something like a noble lie, which in fact becomes a part of the discussion later in the dialogue. Let's turn now to the actual speeches in the Polemarchus section. Polemarchus overlooks the issue of truth-telling and turns instead to the issue of debt-paying, what he's inherited, he thinks, from his father. He tries to meet Socrates' objection to his father's view by calling on the aid of the poet Simonides. But that aid turns out to be insufficient by itself. Polemarchus finds that he cannot take Simonides' statement as a sufficient understanding of justice. He has to interpret what Simonides meant. And of course, it turns out that his interpretation involves a correction of Simonides. Polemarchus is led by Socrates to the view that justice is doing good to friends and harm to enemies, instead of being paying one's debts. Now, implicitly, this interpretation of Simonides and of Cephalus' own view of justice seems to meet Socrates' earlier objection to Cephalus. Most obviously, Polemarchus has specified that justice is not always repaying one's debt, but it is always doing good. So some sense of what is good or fitting for others replaces the conventional notion of debt or property. From this promising beginning, however, Socrates shows Polemarchus that there are difficulties with his way of guarding his father's position. Socrates shows Polemarchus that the son does not know what he claims to know. And in this way, Socrates prepares Polemarchus to participate in a positive and more radical search for justice, freed from his father's opinions about justice. Does it remind you of what Socrates has said about his profession or occupation in the Apology? What he does with Polemarchus is to show this young man that, in fact, he doesn't know what he claims to know. He begins by suggesting that he knows what justice is, perhaps even better than Cephalus does. But Socrates reveals to him that, indeed, he doesn't know. Now, Socrates' examination of Polemarchus consists of three parts, which I've outlined on the board. First, what is fitting for a friend, which is a discussion occurring from 332c, 334c. And that discussion has two steps, which I'll come back to in a moment. Then another large section of the dialogue, in which the topic is, who is a friend? From 334c to 335b. And finally, a discussion of what is fitting for an enemy, from 335b to e, or the end of the Polemarchus section. What I'd like to do now is summarize all three of those parts, and then return to 1a, this step in the first section, and use it as a more detailed example of exactly how Socrates proceeds with Polemarchus. First, Polemarchus is unable to specify what good is done by justice. He seems to rely on the good disposition between friends to discern what is good for friends. And what such good disposition discerns is what friends want. That is, I'm just making an observation about the common understanding of friendship. Our friends are those of us to whom we are well disposed, and our being well disposed makes us attentive to what our friends want or need. We take our bearings in deciding what's good for them by what they want. Polemarchus thus moves away from the law and its notion of property or ownership, but he moves to another problematic view of justice, that a friend should do what his friends want. Socrates attempts to move Polemarchus from his reliance on justice as a good disposition to a view of justice as knowledge. And that is the major theme, I think, of the Polemarchus section. Socrates tries to get Polemarchus to see that justice is more than a good disposition, more than a feeling for the welfare of others. It's knowledge. By the way, you'll see a parallel move in the Thrasymachus section. Thrasymachus begins not with a good disposition, but with strength. And Socrates tries to get Thrasymachus to move beyond strength to knowledge. Justice is not merely strength, but knowledge, he says to Thrasymachus. Now, this effort in the Polemarchus section occurs in the dialogue when Socrates begins to discuss the various techne, T-E-C-H-N-E, a word that I put on the board the last time. This is a word that Bloom translates as art, A-R-T, but which is closer to our meaning of profession. As Bloom tells you in note 22, a techne is a discipline operating on the basis of principles that can be taught. It is, he says, a model of what is rational and intelligible. That is to say, a techne is very far from our notion of what an artist does. A techne is not an art in that sense. It's not a mystical, creative, impenetrable activity. On the contrary, it's that kind of disciplined activity that can be passed on from one person to another, let's say through apprenticeship. Art in the Greek sense is closer to artisan or craftsman than it is to our meaning of an artist. Socrates points out to Polemarchus that each techne or profession knows what is fitting for certain things. In the case of the health professions, for instance, the medical doctor knows which drugs heal the body. The dietitian knows which foods preserve or strengthen the body. And Socrates suggests to Polemarchus that he should be able to identify the comparable acts and subjects or recipients of justice. Polemarchus should be able to tell Socrates which techne is justice. What actually happens is something like this. Through a series of questions, Socrates leads Polemarchus to two conclusions about justice as an art, neither of which identifies exactly what art is justice. First, and I'm referring to A up here now, Socrates gets Polemarchus to the conclusion that the only benefit to others that is not mastered by some art other than justice is guarding or protecting deposits. You recall? He says, well, you know, certain things are done by medicine, certain things are done by horse training, and so forth and so on. What's left over, the only thing that's left over and doesn't have a name, is guarding or protecting deposits. So that must be the art of justice by a process of elimination. And Socrates gets Polemarchus to see that they've come to this ridiculous conclusion. If that's the art of justice, then justice is useful only in useless matters. And it's useless in the most useful or important things of life. That conclusion is reached at 333e. It's meant to point up that the extent to which Polemarchus does not know what he claims to know, and that's pointed up by showing that his own line of thought leads to a ridiculous or absurd conclusion. Second, and I refer now to B under number one, the art of protecting is like other art, Socrates says, in a respect that hasn't been previously mentioned, namely, that the person who possesses the art or skill is able to use it either for good or bad. And he goes through various examples. A horse trainer can use his skill with horses to make a good horse or a bad horse, etc., with the other arts. Since this is true of the art of guarding deposits, the only art that's left over for justice, then the art of justice is as much the art of stealing as it is the art of protecting. You see how he's gotten him to that conclusion? The person who possesses the art of justice can use it every bit as well to steal as to guard. So now there's an even more ridiculous conclusion, that the art of justice is identical with stealing, or is the art of the robber. It is, by the way, at this point that Socrates makes his first criticism of Homer by name, 334b. Later, that theme will become a very important part of the dialogue. By this point in the examination, Polemarchus is absolutely flabbergasted. He's stumped. He admits at 334b that he has absolutely no idea what justice means. And then, like an obstinate schoolboy, he falls back on the definition whose defects Socrates has just disclosed. He says, well, I don't know what the hell's happened, but I still insist that justice is doing good to friends and harming enemies. So Socrates leaves that line of reasoning. He doesn't dwell on the problems that have just been uncovered. Instead, he moves to another part of Polemarchus' definition, that justice is doing good not to everyone, but to friends. If Polemarchus cannot identify the things that justice does, can he identify the people to whom those things are done? Can he identify the proper recipients of justice? Or to put it differently, who are friends? Now, this seemed a simple matter to Polemarchus. Polemarchus was willing to settle for the understanding of friends that governs most of us, that friends are those people one believes to be good and loves. But Socrates raises a problem for this common view by distinguishing between seeming or appearance on the one hand and being or reality on the other. This is a distinction which will become the focus, the fulcrum of the dialogue at a key turning point later in the book. Are friends those who merely seem to be good, but are in fact not good? This would lead to the situation in which benefiting friends was actually benefiting bad human beings, and harming enemies, those who seemed to be bad but were not, amounted to harming those who in fact were good. Polemarchus sees that he's caught in a difficulty, and in order to extricate himself from the difficulty, he changes his mind. He changes the definition. He says, okay, in fact, what I mean by friends is not those who merely seem to be good, but those who seem to be good and are. Those who seem to be good and are. This conclusion, of course, makes the question of the techne of justice even more important, because now that techne must include a knowledge not only of the acts that are just, but a knowledge of who is truly good. Do you see why that second step reflects back on the first? why it makes even more important the question of the techne or expertise in justice? Because in the first large step, the issue was just, well, what is the act of justice? What good does the just man do? But now that question has been doubled. The techne has to also discover who, in fact, is the proper recipient of justice, who is truly good. Finally, in step 3, Roman 3 on the board, Socrates turns to the second half of Polemarchus's definition of justice, that it is not only doing good to friends, but harming enemies. We've already seen that Polemarchus looked to the wants of friends to determine the good that is to be done them. Polemarchus seems to accept a view of life in which the good things, the things that we value, are scarce things. There are not enough of them to go around. And competition for those things is an absolute necessity to life. To aid the wants of some people, whom he calls friends, is to exclude the wants of others, whom he calls enemies. In such a world of competition, the act of taking for oneself and one's friends is always at the same time the act of taking from others. And those others thereby become one's enemies, whether you want them to become enemies or not. The enemies, in their turn, will attempt to take for themselves what has been given to friends. And for that reason, full service to friends requires protecting them against enemies, i.e., doing good to friends requires that you harm enemies. Let me pause. Do you see how that follows from Polemarchus's view? That when he thinks about doing good to friends, he's thinking about a particular kind of good, having more wealth, having more honor, having more reputation. And it's in the nature of those things that they're scarce. In order for some people to have more, other people have to have less. So in taking from some to benefit your friends, you make enemies out of those from whom you take. Socrates, however, poses a difficulty with this view. If justice is the virtue of a human, and harming a human makes him worse with respect to his virtue, then doing harm to enemies will make enemies less just. Let me repeat it. This is a difficulty which has two assumptions in it, which may or may not be true. They're not questioned. If justice is the virtue of a human being, and if harming him, for instance, harming him physically, taking away his property, makes him worse with respect to his virtue, then doing harm to enemies will make enemies less just. If, in addition, the just man is good, then this harming of enemies would involve the just man in a contradiction. The just man would become the cause of other men's being less just. Well, this is utterly unacceptable to Polemarchus. So for a second time, he changes his mind. He sees the difficulty in his position, and he changes that position so that justice becomes doing good to friends, but harming no one. So by the end of the discussion, Socrates has apparently gotten Polemarchus to agree that justice is doing good to friends, but harming no one. Let me make an aside. Do you see, as we move along, why it's not possible to say that Polemarchus's position is one and only one position? He begins with one position. I mean, at the very beginning, he begins with Simonides' view of justice, that justice is paying one's debts. But he ends with a radically different view of justice. And a full account of his view requires indicating what his changes of mind were. Now, don't make the mistake of thinking that by the end of that discussion, justice has become universal benevolence, what we understand to be the inheritance of the Christian tradition, universal compassion. Not at all. Both Socrates and Polemarchus agree that justice is doing good only to friends. But it's also not harming anyone. Now, if the world is in fact a realm of scarce goods acquired through competition, doesn't this understanding of justice doom the just person to an undesirable fate? I mean, what's going to become of the just person if the world is like Polemarchus thought it was? Isn't the just person going to suffer at every turn? I mean, there are all these enemies, and the just person is going to, who cannot, because he's just, do harm to anyone, is going to be defenseless. That will be true if the good things in life consist solely of the scarce goods. But does justice really concern those scarce goods? Or does it concern some good that is not scarce and therefore could be distributed to one's friends without being taken from others? Can you think of any kind of good that could be distributed to other people without being taken from somebody else first?
Knowledge.
I'll bet it's the only one you can think of. Truth. Well, I wouldn't distinguish between them. Knowledge is fully knowledge only if it's truth. Otherwise, it's merely opinion. And it may be true that opinion is not charitable. But full knowledge is. I can think a thought at exactly the same time that you think a thought without either of us thinking a lesser thought. But that's not true of any other good. Now, of course, we say sort of elliptically that we share certain physical goods. You know, he shared his dinner with her. But in that situation, you don't literally share exactly the same good. You know, you take part of what you had and give it away, and somebody else eats it. And what that person eats, you cannot eat. Now, that may sound so commonsensical that it seems ridiculous to emphasize it. It may be the most important fact underlying all politics, that the goods with which politics is preeminently concerned are those goods which in their nature cannot be truly shared among people. They're scarce goods for which competition is a necessity. We could put it this way at the end of the Polemarchus section. Polemarchus' view of justice seems to have implicit in it a political view, or at least there is a respectable political view of justice which is close to Polemarchus's. It's a view that Bloom talks about a bit in his interpretive essay, that for the citizen, his friends are his fellow citizens, and his enemies are aliens, and especially enemy aliens, and that there's something in the nature of politics that requires every good citizen, regardless of his particular city or political community, to defend or do good to fellow citizens and be willing to harm enemies. That something, what makes it a necessity, may very well be tied to the kind of goods sought by politics, those scarce goods that cannot truly be shared. So that the more one political community has of them, by necessity, the less somebody else has of them. And those others become enemies who must be fended off if we are to keep our own. It's worth remembering that Socrates challenged that view of justice. He suggested a view that seems to require not harming enemies and therefore seems to disregard politics or go beyond politics. That view, we've suggested, has to do with knowledge as a good, and we'll see how he deals with that dilemma later. We've come only to this point so far, that Socrates' discussion with Polemarchus, once we think about it, reveals a tension between two understandings of justice. On the one hand, the understanding of justice which is compatible with scarce goods and which requires helping friends and harming enemies. On the other hand, that kind of justice that's compatible with shareable goods and requires doing good to friends but harming no one. Whether those two goods can be put together is a tremendous problem that we'll have to wait till later in the dialogue to answer. Pause. Do you see what the difficulty is and how it emerges out of the Polemarchus section? Any problems with the parts of the Polemarchus section? I'm going to return now to the very first step. Do you see any particular difficulties?
Are you saying that you have enemies merely because you only have limited resources and you can only give those limited resources to certain people, so people who don't get anything are limited enemies?
Yes, I am. I'm going that far, outlandish as it may seem. I think the easiest way to envision it for us today is to think about the relationship between the United States and the Third World. Perfect case of what I'm talking about. Now, many of us, moved by something like the standard of universal benevolence, insist that America's wealth should be equally distributed. But that, in a way, begs the question, because what the Third World really wants, according to this view, is not simply equal distribution, but as much as they want. They want more than anybody else. That's not because they're the Third World, that's because they're human. But in order to get even an equal amount, let alone more than we have, what do they have to do? They have to take from us. That makes the third world, according to this view, I'm not preaching that view, but according to this view, that makes the third world, potentially at least, our enemy. They are not by nature our friend. If the best things in life are the scarce goods of life, that's the premise of this view. Does that make any sense? I know most of you don't like it because it sounds like a terribly right-wing, harsh, cold-blooded view of things.
I saw it. The enemy is being something else, though, merely than just... Are you saying the only reason that you're an enemy is because you haven't given him the thing that you give to other people as well?
Well, in a way, yes. Although, you see, that's, the best reason for him to be your enemy, because you're giving something to somebody else means for him that he doesn't get it. In fact, in the extreme case, it means it's been taken from him. So your friendship with someone else is an act of hostility toward him. Now you may cover that over and say, oh, no, I just love so-and-so and I want to give him everything I can and so forth and so on, and ignore the result for the other person. But the other person doesn't ignore it. There's a half of the truth which the benefiter of the friend tends to ignore. You see, it's the other person who emphasizes that half of the truth more than anything else and then acts on it and therefore becomes a real enemy and not simply a potential enemy.
So then would you say that for everything you give away to someone else, you neglect someone else's wants, then there's no way that you can have a threat without creating an enemy?
That's right. Providing only one thing is true, that the best way to benefit a friend is by increasing his or her unshareable goods. Things like wealth, reputation, honor. If that's the only way to benefit the friend, then what you just said, I think, is true.
Okay, then by taking away from someone else and give to someone else, doesn't that make you unjust?
That's Socrates' point, in a way. He doesn't carry it quite that far. He suggests that it's possible to do good to friends without harming anyone else. But that possibility, I'm suggesting, requires that he shift from the scarce goods to some other kind of good. You see, it's possible to do good to friends and not harm anyone else only if you're talking about a genuinely shareable good. Because if you were still talking about the unshareable goods, then the very act of benefiting someone would harm someone else. So the last definition they come to is possible only if they've tacitly adopted a different view of what's really good in life or what really benefits one in life. Namely, some unshareable good. Knowledge is the only one we've mentioned, rather than the scarce good. Did I say some unshareable good? Some shareable good. Thank you. Jonathan?
It would seem for a lot of the argument that if we're going to take the view of justice as only referring to things that aren't scarce or things that are scarce, we're going to end up in a position where we're going to say that politics and political community, by its definition, is unjust, or we're going to end up with a view saying that this other idea of justice, that there's something that's not scarce, is unrealistic.
Why, and why unrealistic? Can you elaborate that just a second?
Well, because if it's true that the only goods that we can really talk about are scarce, then when we postulate that there's something else beyond this that's not scarce, then it almost starts to sound like some kind of almost like a religious argument.
Yes, certainly an idealist argument, right? Yeah. Let me heighten the difficulty. What's especially problematic is that the second understanding of justice as involving a shareable good, is possible only if you leave aside all of the scarce goods and ignore them. Well, can we? Is that a human possibility? What would it mean for your life if you ignored all of the scarce goods? You would not be worried about getting food, for instance. You'd die. There seems to be something terribly unrealistic about the second understanding of justice. And therefore the question, can they be put together, can they be harmonized, is one hell of a question. It's not going to be easy, if indeed it's going to be possible at all. Now, you may say at this point, well, if it's not possible, what's the point? Why go through all of this, even though it may be true? Is it practical? You know? Yes. Even if it were true that those two understandings of justice cannot be put together, and we decided that we are political beings, we have to attend to the scarce goods, we would have learned something about the limits or necessities of politics that we otherwise might have overlooked. Remember that harsh right-wing view I mentioned earlier? Well, if one came to the conclusion that Polemarchus was correct about the nature of the goods that one ought to pursue, and that pursuing those goods inevitably created enemies, then one might be willing to entertain some foreign policies that don't seem so palatable to us right now. Well, let me put it in terms of domestic policy. If Polemarchus's view is right, if the political view is justified, then we would be less prone to say glibly, spend all the money that you need to keep somebody with a bad heart alive. Spend all the money you need to, because obviously life is a good thing and you should keep that person alive. If we accepted Polemarchus's view, we would realize that the money spent to keep that person alive is money deprived from other people, taken away from other people, let's say people on welfare. Those are hard choices, and that's one thing one might learn, and learn very powerfully, if you came to the conclusion that those two notions of justice are irreconcilable. Or, to put it differently, that justice as doing good to friends and harming no one is not a possibility for those of us who have bodies, i.e. all of us. Well, we'll come back to that. Don't give it up yet. At this point, if you have gotten a glimpse of the two different understandings of justice that seem to be emerging in the discussion, you will have made considerable progress. Are the two understandings clear? One based on scarce goods, which says justice is doing good to friends and harming enemies. One based on shareable, genuinely shareable goods, which says that justice is doing good to friends and harming no one. Sarah?
Are you defining inaction as harm? Okay, if you do good for a friend in a scarce environment, still by not doing an active harm to an enemy, okay, you go out and you pick a coin and give it to your friend. You're not actively harming an enemy. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I see what you mean. I'm going to beg off on it, and very much the way Socrates begs off on it. You notice that in the last step of the discussion, Roman 3, he never says exactly what he means by harm. In fact, he seems to twist Polemarchus's meaning. Polemarchus seems to have meant physical injury, or at least material injury. Socrates seems to mean doing something to someone's character, and those may be very different things, involving very different kinds of acts. I'll beg off on that for the moment. We have one other question, then I want to turn back to that first section and take us a little bit farther. Somebody else had a point? Willing to hold it for now? Let me go back then to the first step in the first large section. As we do, it's important to keep in mind what Socrates gets Polemarchus to admit at the end of this first step. This is the very first section of their exchange. He gets Polemarchus to admit that justice is guarding deposits. Unbeknownst to Polemarchus, there may be a more significant truth in this conclusion than seems to be present in his current formulation. Socrates seems to have trivialized justice. He has reduced Polemarchus to saying that justice, as guarding deposits, is useful only in useless things. But is there a kind of guarding that is more useful than the guarding of deposits? In fact, Polemarchus had already hit upon such a significant guarding when he said at 332e that we do good to our friends most in making war and being an ally in battle. Polemarchus had there permitted Socrates to pass over this kind of guarding without comment and to go on to justice in peacetime. We, of course, know that from reading ahead in the Republic that it's precisely this kind of guarding, the guarding done by warriors or soldiers, that preoccupies the discussants when they begin to found the just city. You know, the first people they train in the just city are precisely warriors, those whose task it is to guard. The warriors have a claim to be the most serious of guardians, for they guard not deposits, but the city itself. Or to put it a different way, the warriors or soldiers guard all of the arts of peacetime, whose superior worth, that is, whose superiority over guarding deposits, is not questioned even by Socrates. Socrates admits that all these arts, like medicine and horse training and so forth, are worth more than guarding deposits. But the warriors are the ones who guard those other arts. So they seem to have a very large claim to being serious guarding, in contrast to the deposit guarder whose task is useless guarding. Now this thought, which seems to be a victory for Polemarchus had he carried it out, would in fact have been only a temporary victory. Isn't it true of guarding the city, as it was true of most of the other good activities examined by Socrates, that there is a separate art, other than justice, whose task it is to guard the city, an art of war, an art of generalship, or an art of command? So that art of guarding the city, is not properly called justice, but the art of generalship. Thus, the art of the general takes its place beside the art of the doctor, the art of the pilot, the farmer, the shoemaker, the draft player, the horse builder, the harp player, the horseman, the shipbuilder, etc. That incredibly long list of special arts that Socrates had laid out. The art of guarding the city does not seem to be the art of justice. So this temporary victory of Polemarchus's seems to be only temporary. Nevertheless, it's an important temporary victory because it calls our attention to something else about the argument that has been passed over. What Socrates and Polemarchus have done is to divide life up into many parts and to claim then that some expertise corresponds to each of those parts. That list I just read, you know, part of life is having a healthy body, and there's the doctor. Part of life is building a house, and there's a house builder, and so forth. Life has been chopped up, and there is an art that corresponds to each part. This seems to be true of war, just as it's true of every other special art. But hasn't Polemarchus overlooked one possibility? Mightn't there be an art, or a science, an expertise, whose subject is the proper place of each of the other arts? Let me repeat it. What they've looked at is all the special arts, which presume that life is chopped up into many fragmented parts. They've never asked the question, is there an art whose job it is to assign the proper place to each of the special arts? Given the great variety of all the special arts, the question naturally arises, what is the proper role of each of these many arts in the life of the city? The art that answers that question, if there is such an art, would be an art that has not yet been named, an art that might deserve the name justice. For surely the art that directs the other arts must know not only what is good for the health of the body, or for home building, or for money making, or for waging war, but that guiding art must know what is good for the human being as a whole. Do you see? Only if there is an art which can discover what's truly good for the human being, can that art then assign each special art its proper role. What contribution should money-making make to a completely good human life? What contribution should war make to that good life and so forth? Only with this knowledge can all of the other arts keep their proper place. But this knowledge of the proper place of each art is not contained within any of the special arts themselves. So justice may be a useful techne after all, if there is a techne, an art, of guarding in this very special sense, an art that can keep each of the special arts safe from interference from the other arts by keeping each art in its proper place. And as I've said, the task of such an art will be to guide each special art in making its contribution to the best way of life. Once again, we're taken back to the importance of knowledge. That is to say, once again we see that justice will be possible only if there is a kind of knowledge or expertise that knows what each art should contribute to the best way of life. That, I think, by the way, is not merely an example in the dialogue. It turns out to be the most important subject of Book One. And you'll see.
He doesn't live either in the mountains or in the valleys, but he goes back and forth. As to why he comes down, it's a perplexing question. On page 676 is a quote from Zarathustra that I think is one of the finest in all of Nietzsche, and his understanding of what a student is supposed to do with his doctrine. Is what he's supposed to do with Nietzsche. And he tells you, you know, for God's sake, don't believe me. For God's sake. That's a lovely passage. Really, classic. But I also happen to like the quote on the page facing 676. And in reading Nietzsche, I'm continually struck with, just struck with it. What he's saying. The last sentence of that is staggering to me. How could I fail to be grateful for my whole life? Which is, I think, a brief statement of that doctrine of amor fati that I think is at the core of Nietzsche, the love of faith. And the first time I read that, it just floored me because I started thinking about my whole life and how much I regretted large parts of my life. How much, you know, I was ashamed of stupid things I did and errors, and how much things from the past kind of haunted me like a ghost, you know, certain kinds of, you know, what do you remember and what do you forget out of your life? You forget, what is the principle of selection that determines what you remember? And, you know, following along the lines of Freud, which I think is not a bad guide, one of the things you remember are traumas, things that you can't forget because there's so much, pain involved with it, or disappointment.
You can't forget anything.
Huh?
I don't believe you can forget anything.
What did you have for breakfast?
Temporarily black it out, 10 black years it ago, out of your mind.
This morning, you know, you don't remember that.
It's up there. I mean,
what good does that do you if you can't get it?
You can get it. All you have to do is command, will it.
Oh, really? Will yourself to remember what you did when you were 2 days old?
Well,
maybe
before,
I could.
Before language, is there any research on that? You know about?
Okay, well, will yourself to remember what you were doing exactly a year ago today?
Wait, we've asked. Is there any research on it?
I believe you can do
people
it.
People that are put into trances and they go back to not only this life, but the last life and then
it
the life before that.
You know, like
some people really get into.
But that's not verifiable.
They do verify it by saying that they're. How would anybody know of a street name that the street has been from now is now gone? And how would anybody know that this house existed with this number in it and what it really looked like? And they go back and they find pictures of it. And the house is no longer, you know, like, understandably somebody could research that out and then go in and you know, be a dummy and do that, but not likely.
But you're making an embarrassingly strong case. I just wanted him to remember breakfast 10 years ago.
Well, if you gave me time, I might be able to.
Maybe it's true, but it's...
Yeah, how will we check your answer, though?
It's stronger than is necessary.
I was just saying that it does happen, that kind of thing.
It's possible. I mean, I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility that you could remember your breakfast 10 years ago.
Well, anything you read or anything... The saying right now is still recording up here into your memory cells. That's not
it's
being erased. I mean, where does it go?
I don't know where it goes. I mean, it seems to me it's a scientific question that it could be resolved at a certain point.
What I'm trying to say that, okay, like things that you hear today in class, you might not remember everything. Mm-hmm. You might not remember the points. Maybe, like you said, maybe 5 years from now, that point to come to you, and you can use that point, and it'll be great for you.
I'm not denying that. All I'm trying to say is, what do you remember of your past? What kinds of things, without any special effort, what do you remember of your past?
All experiences.
At least in part, you remember bad things. You remember good things too, but at least in part, you have the return of the, what Freud calls the return of the repressed. You have return
of.
Still
make you shiver and you know what happened.
Yeah, there's some stuff that, that strikes you with the same emotional force no matter how long ago it happened. Well, that's what I was. I was thinking, I'm not grateful for my whole life. There's a lot of it I'd like to go over again, but what would it mean to be able to say sincerely, I'm grateful for my entire life, including those things? You know, I think it means the same thing as what Freud would mean by saying you were healthy. Is you could accept, A, you could bring it to consciousness, the worst, you could remember the worst, and B, accept it.
How about learn from it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's I would include. I think that's what Nietzsche means in one way by being healthy. And that is very close to Freud's goal, I think, ideal goal. That he thinks nobody can be in reality yet. But I think Nietzsche means something that radical by almost all. To save your life, even its worst moments, well, that was part of my becoming what I am. Necessary. I mean, it would mean living without those pains, overcoming all of those pains, whatever they are. I don't know how to describe that pain of remembering these horrible events that I can't even tell you about because it's still charged.
You say those pains are necessarily bad.
I think they're necessarily bad. Let me tell you, to go back to Freud, I'm sorry to harp on Freud all the time. But for me, I really like Freud, and I think it's another place where maybe you can tie into what Nick is saying. Freud's analysis of neurosis, and why neurosis is bad, comes down at its core to this. That when you have a traumatic experience, it makes you unable to learn or to experience anything in that area. You stop at a certain point, whenever you have an experience like that, in some way it creates a structure which limits what you can learn. And that you have to bring all the details of that to your consciousness and overcome it in your mind before you can learn in that area. That's why it's bad, is because it's a barrier. You know, if you're wounded in love or something, until you overcome that wound, you can't experience anything beyond that.
You sometimes understand it better because of the great trauma that's involved with it. You get something out of it you otherwise wouldn't have had.
Ideally you would, but there are wounds that are so painful that you're afraid to risk again in that area.
Haven't completely healed up yet?
Yeah. They never heal. I mean, that's what a neurosis is in the real bad sense of the word. I mean, not in the everybody is neurotic sense of the word, but in the sense of Dora, for example, in the case study of Dora, had hysterical symptoms involved things like feeling she was choking, and, just things that were these really horrible physical sensations when a certain kind of experience came up. So I think that's why it's bad. And you're not able to learn from it until you're able to recognize, to relive it and accept it in a certain way. And I think that's the kind of barrier that Nietzsche's talking about with being grateful for your whole life. To me, it's a staggering idea. Just maybe impossible. Well, gee, we've gone through four pages
already. Can I ask you a question before
yes.
we go on?
Yes.
It's on page 676.
Yeah.
When he speaks up, he says, "The man of knowledge must not only love his enemies, he must also be able to hate his friends." Could you explain that?
We're going to come to that very... The doctrine of friendship, in fact, I think is at the end of this next section on either wisdom or... Yeah, we'll talk about this in the next section on why I am so wise about friendship and what a friendship ought to be, if it's okay. I realize I'm putting most of your questions off this ideal future one. I'm going to tell the truth about everything. Why I am so wise. I don't mean to. I'd like you to read this, if you haven't, on 676, this quote from Zarathustra, because I think it's really a great guide to what he's talking about. What is wisdom? What kind of claim is Nietzsche making? And if you're going to talk about being wise, what do we want to talk about? And does Nietzsche talk about those things? If you're going to talk about being wise, why doesn't he talk about his schooling? I took this great course in social ethics and became wise.
Wisdom came from yourself?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's going to tell us where his wisdom came from. But it's not, unless you're very different from me, it's not the same place. And it's coming from an unexpected place. Do you have a question?
Well,
comment?
No, I was just going to say that, like, his schooling, he wouldn't say it comes from schooling, because that's precisely the thing he wants people.
Sure.
He says it's volume 679. The reason why a revaluation of values is perhaps possible for me to learn.
He is directing us to a different source for wisdom. But just in our common sense world, I think we would not talk about what he's talking about. I mean, he talks about sickness as a source of wisdom. Right? I mean, that's just a very strange thing to talk about.
So that's his telling us himself that we are supposed to look at that
ground.
Sure.
When you're reading this, don't you get to wondering if he's being humorous, if he's being really serious?
And you never know.
For two lines, you know, this is pretty funny, you know, you get really serious. So there's some humor here in 679 where he says that it's not your nerves, it's rather than our nerves.
Yeah.
It does.
But it's interesting to think about humor. There's no reason why humor doesn't concern serious things. In fact, I think it's almost essential for something to be humorous that it be. I said we can see the ideas of this. I think, you know, the profound content of humor is almost always that it's about something unspeakable. And a taboo topic or a topic too painful to talk about in everyday discourse. Right? So I think it can be both humorous and profound. Sometimes it is silly, but very often Nietzsche's humor is both. Well, I don't want to attempt to talk about what he means by wisdom in the first thing. I know we talk about that last. But just to talk about these sections, which are, every one of them offers paradoxes. The first one on the good fortune of my existence, its uniqueness perhaps, again claiming a unique kind of life, lies in its fatality. I am, to express it in the form of a riddle, already dead as my father, while as my mother I am still living and becoming old. Well, what does that mean?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it sure is. The entire passage is about that riddle. He's as dead as his father, while as his mother he's still living and becoming old. He's at the same time somebody who's dead and alive. Who has an answer to that riddle?
Doesn't it have something to? It's my understanding that his father died when he was really young, and he was brought up by his mother and sisters.
That's right.
So it would seem to me, at least a reasonable guess to start with, that he's saying something about that relationship in particular, about and his father being dead. That doesn't have the influence of his father as well, or as strongly, or opposed to the influence that came from the women.
I mean, that's a very important clue. There's one other clue you ought to have. In the second paragraph, he talks about his great crisis. Nietzsche had a tremendous crisis of health and spirit when he was 36 years old, in which he quit his professorship, went to the mountains, left his entire life behind him. And that his father died when his father was 36. So Nietzsche is saying, at the age of 36, I went through a death and a rebirth. And I think that's the other fact that you need to put together, at least on the surface, what he's saying. Saying that his life after this crisis in 1878, 1879, his father's life continued. Now, I don't even know how to even at that level, I don't know how to interpret what that means. You'd have to be a psychoanalyst in a certain sense to understand that kind of identification with his parents, with his father's mother. He gives some clue in here. I've never really tried to figure it out. A little bit later, we talked about his father's character and all of that. But that's certainly the superficial level of the rhythm he's talking about.
I don't understand the sentence right after that. The dual descent.
This dual descent, as it were, both from the highest and the lowest rung on the ladder of life, birth and death. At the same time, a decadent and a beginning.
But it sounds like he's, I don't know, I could be wrong in doing this, but he talks about his father dying and his mother living, and then he talks about the highest and the lowest, and then the decadent and the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds as if the highest is the death and the lowest is the becoming old.
I mean, I think more specifically what he's talking about is sickness and health. The way in which his, I mean, that's the center of this section is on, his health was terrible. Although, again, nobody knows at this point exactly what caused it. Migraine headaches. Any of you have migraine headaches? Just don't. Incredibly, their headaches of such intensity that they stop everything else. Poor eyesight. I mean, I don't know what they meant by weak constitution, you know, at the end of the 19th century. Yeah. Well, he describes a lot of these things. But he was a person of whose life seems to decay in periods of terrible sickness of this sort, weakness and happiness and so on. And yet he says paradoxically that this sickness, which for anybody else would be a period of the decline of life, for him was the cause of a rebirth, of a growth. That sickness was a means to health. That's part of the doctrine of this section of Why I Am So Wise. It says, the following winter, my first one in Genoa, that sweetening and spiritualization, which is almost inseparably connected with an extreme poverty of blood and muscle, produced the dawn. The perfect brightness and cheerfulness, even exuberance of the spirit reflected in this work, is compatible in my case not only with the most profound physiological weakness, but with an excess of pain. In section two, I think kind of the conclusion of this argument about the mixture of decline and beginning, he says on page 680, for it should be noted it was during the years of my lowest vitality that I ceased to be a pessimist. The instinct of self-restoration forbade me a philosophy of poverty and discouragement. Okay, just all of that simply to summarize this paradox that he's talking about. Does it make any sense to any of you at all? Does it? Tell me about that.
So I was wondering why he said he ceased to be a pessimist. How does that tie into it? He became an optimist when he was sick?
Yeah, exactly. That he had been not only a sickly person, but a pessimistic, unhappy person. And through this terrible period of pain and disease, he became an optimist. Just the opposite of what you think. You think that as his body became more and more decrepit, his spirit would decline into morbidity. But he says just the opposite. I became a cheerful, life-affirming person through sickness.
In other words, he's saying that, to me, he's saying that sickness is really kind of all psychological. Because, no, it's the way you think. Like, if you think that you're sick, if you notice at times, if you've ever been sick, and you really sit down and you think about, I'm sick, you really get sick. So, In other words, he started, his instinct, which is an instinct for survival, which is in all of us, took the better of him, and he took on an optimistic point of view that he would continue to fight,
yeah,
because he could have gave up like the Russian, the Russian soldier he speaks of, who's just
lies down in the snow
and gives up life.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, for him, the turning point came when he kicked all the doctors out. He stopped going to the doctor. I mean, this is where we come back to that, what, you know, that comment I made at the beginning of class. Why do some people catch, it's some incredible figure, like 20% of the population gets 80% of the goals. And it's something like that.
Psychological.
So, so-called psychosomatic, I mean, that's always used as an insult, you know. You're not sick. It's psychosomatic. You know. And Nietzsche's saying, of course. Again, parallel to Freud, there's everything about the human body has a psychological aspect, and to say you're psychosomatic means you're like everybody else. And Freud said even accident is the case of disease that might be non-psychosomatic, but Freud says accidents don't happen randomly to people. Some people have lots of accidents, and some people have accidents when they're in periods of stress. Everything is psychosomatic, that is, both mind and body.
Also, the way I understood this, I was thinking about the birth of tragedy and some of the things that he was saying in there. And it seems like it's only through tragedy, as the Greeks, you know, did through their plays and things, that we really realize life. Like, take, for instance, war or something like that. War is a tragic thing. But then again, it's good, because when you have wars, scale of the economy goes up, people are working, everybody seems to be happy. It's also a way of controlling the population, something like this. And this is what I believe we should be speaking of in terms.
I mean, I think that's a very productive link to tragedy. Yeah. There's a more, even more radical argument about war. William James, the moral equivalent to war, talked about the best human characteristics come out in military situations. If you want to get rid of war, you have to find a similar situation of stress that, so people can experience those virtues.
But isn't he also saying here, like when you're healthy, you don't really realize a lot of things. Like, you don't really know who you are. Well, you know who you are, but you might not attempt to go any further. But when you're sick and everything down, it gives you time to think about things, and it's only through sickness, when you have to fight to regain your health, that you can overcome yourself. Could he be saying that?
Yeah, I think he is. I think that's what he's saying, but what I want to know is, isn't that a weird thing to be saying? Have any of you ever experienced the sickness as a means towards health? I once asked that question in class when somebody was paralyzed. He said yes. The most radical kind of not sickness, but accident, in which you lost control of his limbs. He said yes, which just stopped the class.
And
of course, we couldn't go any further.
He's no longer, but he was healthy then.
Yes, that is spiritually healthy.
Oh, but he still couldn't do that.
That's right. The question is, where do you think healthy dies?
Just maybe out of context, but Stevie Wonder wrote some stuff about this. He said, because of my blindness, I can see further than most people. That's why I can read my music.
Homer.
Or that song.
Yeah.
Homer's
18.
Yeah?
Fascinating to me is
looking
back at what we did last week. And having read the answers and knowing that Nietzsche himself was so lonely. And, He wrote in the Gay Science, I read the last song he wrote, and it's so healthy. It's in his loneliness, he knew that he loved people and he wanted to have people and he wanted to have people who understood him. But he also knew that in order to have the freedom that he needed to write, he had to be lonely. And in that paradox, he was exuberant, and he wrote such
start unraveling this is, assuming that most people drift through their life and in some kind of mixture of healthiness and sickness, at what point can you make a decision to make your life a work of art, which is, I think, what Nietzsche is really advocating. Beyond Good and Evil, he says, to look at life as an experiment of the thinker. To take hold of your life as something, not that you go along reacting to stimuli and let events direct you. At what point do you suddenly say, it's my life, and I'm going to seek certain kinds of, I'm going to seek what's good for me, I'm going to become what I am. What is it? What is the point at which somebody can get hold of their life like that? And for Nietzsche, it was the lowest point, the point of sickness, in which he made a decision. The instinct of self-restoration forbade me a philosophy of poverty and discouragement, but he couldn't afford one, because he was going to be an invalid. And that moment in his life, I mean, in a way, he can be grateful for the sickness which caused him immense pain, because it provided a moment at which he could make a decision to live a certain kind of life. But none of us, I think, would probably be brought to having to make that decision. It's because we're all getting along. It's not good, but it's not bad. But it's living.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, though, that you can't make that conscious decision about that. It's part of realization. It's an issue. But it's not really a decision.
Not in an ordinary sense. No, it's a decision in the sense that Rousseau, riding through the countryside, was struck by a thought and fell from his horse. Being struck by a thought of that intensity, or the conversion of St. Augustine. Conversion is another word. Just having a point in your life of total recognition of yourself.
When you accept this terror, you eliminate many meanings from life, and the aesthetic phenomenon and the possibility of becoming a good art is the remaining possibility to give it something in itself.
Okay, I mean, to take that round of argument, what is it that reduces possibility, that says X was a possibility but is not anymore? But what brings you to the point of revaluing the everyday?
Some
I don't know. I mean, you can say the truth and I wouldn't know it.
No, I don't either. I just think it seems to me to be what causes paralysis.
For Nietzsche, it was this moment. I guess in terms of predicting where we're headed, in terms of the papers, I don't know how long it's going to take me to read those papers. It seems to be terribly unwise to assign them.
Fine, don't assign it anymore.
I left.
But it seems to me that maybe the only way you're going to keep your thinking under control is to...